you know, where we are compiling recipes that are nutrient-dense foods that are made from actually organic ingredients that are actually cheaper than buying processed foods.
And not just oatmeal.
And healthier.
516.
Not just oatmeal.
620-3602.
Although you could make oatmeal in the pan.
Here's a Quaker joke. 516-620-3602. We want to get 10 more of you on the line before the top of the hour. We've got just 2 minutes left before we get to the next program, but we want you to support this program, Green Street. Again, you can hear them regularly on Tuesday nights at 8 p.m., alternating with Ecologic. Green Street at Tuesday at 8 p.m. That's where you find the environmental programming here. But right now, let's get the phones lit up, folks. In these final couple of minutes, support what you've heard here. The $75 pledge of support gets you this cast iron skillet. You've done two things. You've made a pledge in support of WBAI, but also in support of your own health, also in support of your family's health. And I think you made a great point a moment ago, Patty, about the fact that how pregnant women are affected by these chemicals. It's important. Maybe this isn't an item for you. Maybe you know someone that's pregnant and you can share this with them. Maybe they wouldn't be receptive otherwise, or maybe they're not a WBAI listener. But you can pledge at the $75 level for that person's health or for someone else that you know. But getting these chemicals out of our diets is key to a healthier digestive function, healthier brain function, healthier organ function for all of us, folks. It's something that was put onto us that we must change, and it simply takes you dialing 516-620-3602. Be that final caller to get us to our pledge of support.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you, Michael G. Haskins, our engineer. Thank you, Patty. Thanks to everybody who called in. We appreciate your support. We look forward to seeing you on a future show of Green Street. Thank you.
During 2016's election, some people asked, do words matter? Twitter aside, here are some words that matter to all of us here at WBAI. Listener supporter, commercial-free resistance radio. Hi, my name's Manya. I'm host of Through the Opera Glass, which you can hear on Sundays at noon. Please take a minute to consider what your radio landscape would look like without this station. At WBAI, we consider you a part of our vital community. So please consider making a tax-free donation to this station. At WBAI, we keep it grassroots. We're powered by your generosity, not corporate interests. Your money empowers us to deliver in-depth news coverage, provocative conversations, and, of course, arts programs. Remember to donate by visiting give2wbai.org or pledge right now from your smartphone. Text WBAI to 41444. Thanks in advance.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. The time is just about 8 o'clock. It's time once again for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse.
Very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Alex.
Good evening.
Voltaire.
Hey there.
And Kyle.
Yeah, what up?
Well, it's going to be kind of hard to do a show tonight because a lot of crap going on in the world, a lot of crap going on in this country. For those listening in the future wondering just when God's name happened this time, yet another terror attack on our soil, sponsored by the NRA. I don't want to get into it, but you know there was an interesting story I just read the first paragraph of this in the Los Angeles Times, that really kind of wakes you up to this age of Google and algorithms and things like that. If you started typing school shooting into Google search this afternoon, you may have noticed that autofill took over and anticipated the next word today. So even the bloodless algorithms within Google recognize that when one tries to find information about a fresh school shooting, the search needs to be narrowed because people are still searching the school shooting from last week and the one before that and the one before that. We are 6 weeks into 2018, and so far there have been at least six shooting incidents on school grounds. And that's all we're going to say about that this show. But I'm sure you'll hear all kinds of reports and bemoaning and things like that ahead in the weeks, months to come before everyone forgets about it and goes back to the way it was time and time again. All right, enough of that. We have to do a fundraising show tonight. So hopefully we can help this station stay on the air so we can confront the issues and beat our heads against the wall and hopefully make change. It would be nice to see, but it does get awfully frustrating sometimes. How have you guys been?
I'm all right.
Yeah?
I'm hanging in there. Like you said, bit of a somber day.
Yeah.
You know, despite it being Valentine's Day.
Yes, it's not 30 degrees anymore.
No, well, that doesn't. Neither of those things cheer me up. By the way, being Valentine's Day and it not being cold.
We're being warm. You don't like warm weather?
Not in the winter. No.
Iceland really changed you.
No, Iceland wasn't cold enough, but
it reaffirmed your beliefs.
Greenland next time. This is interesting, though. A story that's kind of near and dear to our hearts because it involves the NSA. Did you hear about this incident that took place today at the NSA? Ongoing investigation. Apparently, what happened, three people, including a police officer, were hospitalized today in a bizarre incident at the super secret National Security Agency after officers apparently opened fire on a black SUV carrying three men as it breached the main gate. Authorities have not determined why the car crashed through the entrance before ramming a concrete barricade. There is no indication to think that this is anything more than an isolated incident, according to the FBI. They arrested two passengers, the car's driver, and non-life-threatening injuries were sustained. Of course, they did open fire on the car, which is a bit extreme. It's unclear why the car, believed to be a rental with New York tags, we all accounted for. It's the kind of thing that, didn't we drive down there, Kyle, with a rental with New York tags and incur the wrath of the NSA police?
You know, as much as it's a super secret facility, you can go down there, and they have a visitor's lot and a museum there, and, you know, it's perfectly accessible, at least to the perimeter, so that's not unusual, but and no one I know is involved.
Well, the vehicle came onto NSA's compound unauthorized, according to authorities. NSA police responded accordingly. An NSA spokesman said weapons were discharged in the incident. However, the weapons were discharged by the NSA or by responding police. Of course, we know the NSA collects, processes, and disseminates intelligence information from foreign electronic signals for national foreign intelligence and counterintelligence purposes. It also oversees code breaking and monitors federal government computer networks to counter cyber terrorism. It also spies on U.S. citizens and breaks the law on a regular basis. That wasn't in the story. I added that because
the
story needs a little fleshing out here. Despite prominent highway signs, drivers occasionally take the wrong exit and end up at the tightly secured gates. I've done this. I know exactly what they're talking about. The gates are right there. Now, most motorists then carefully follow the orders of heavily armed federal officers and turn around without getting into more trouble. But sometimes that doesn't happen.
When you're done with the story, I have a story about this.
We all have a story
about
this. We haven't done this, but we've gone down there.
Yeah.
And
well, my story has an interesting end to it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you obviously survived.
I did.
But let me tell two other quick stories, and then we'll tell your story.
Yeah.
In 2015, two people were shot by NSA police when they disobeyed orders outside the heavily secured campus. One driver died at the scene after NSA police opened fire on a stolen sports utility vehicle. Authorities said the two people stole the car from a man who picked them up for a party at a motel, which is completely irrelevant to the story, and I don't care. The fact is that they were shot just for not following orders or backing a car in a particular direction. It seems a bit extreme. And then in 1993, A gunman opened fire outside the entrance to the Central Intelligence Agency in Virginia, killing two CIA employees in their car and wounding three others. Again, that has absolutely nothing to do with this story. I don't understand how USA Today is feeding that information. That's just propaganda. It's like, yeah, someone killed CIA officers. Therefore, NSA is going to shoot people that don't follow their orders. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, it is a bizarre thing, and I've obviously, you know, having worked in the intelligence community, I've been to both places. But prior to being in the intelligence community, I was working for the Army back in 2003.
Which Army?
The U.S. Army.
Okay.
And
just checking.
Good question.
Yeah, I have to ask these questions.
Very, very good question. Right. In any event, I was, you know, my normal self. I wanted to go to the National Cryptological Museum that is run by the NSA. That's pretty close to the NSA, and I'm sort of a geospatial idiot at the same time. You know, I can't follow directions. This is, you know, sort of the days of MapQuest and things like that. We didn't have GPS in cars. So I'm driving down, I think it was the GW Parkway or something like that, towards the NSA.
Yeah, the one that goes between Baltimore and D.C.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you go to New York Ave and D.C. and then over to the GW Parkway.
Let's not give people directions. Yep. They can find it on their own.
They can look it up now. And so in any event, I'm going over there. I get lost. I'm finally circling around. I find the museum, and there's like a little checkpoint Charlie for me to go through in order to get into the museum, which I thought was somewhat unusual. And there's a person in uniform that goes over there and asks me, she sort of looks out the window and asks me for identification. And I hand her my license. And I was actually driving a car with Vermont plates that day, because I was living in Vermont in law school. And she asked me what I was doing there. And I said, well, I'm here for the National Cryptological Museum. And she wrote down my information and whatnot. And then she just waved me through and she said, go ahead and park right over there. So I go in there and I park and I get out and I have a digital camera with me. It was pretty big and bulky back in 2003. And I'll never forget, a security guy smoking a pipe, older gentleman, very nice, comes up to me and he says, excuse me, sir, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm going inside. And he said, is that a phone that you have in your hand? And I said, no, it's a camera. And he said, what are you doing with a camera? You can't have a camera here. I said, well, I wanted to take a picture of the Enigma. He said, what the hell is the Enigma? I said, you know, is that German cryptological device?
Wait, someone on NSA grounds doesn't know what Enigma is?
Didn't know what an Enigma was. I had explained to him what the Enigma was, and then he paused for 2 or 3 seconds. He looked me in the eyes, and he said, are you looking for the museum? And I said, yes, I am, sir. And he said, well, this is not the museum. This is the NSA. I don't know how you got in here. Literally, all I said was to this woman, National Cryptological, whatever, and she just waved me right through. And you know, oblivious me, didn't even realize. I just went over and parked, realized I was in the parking lot of the NSA.
What exactly did you say to her?
I was here for the National Cryptological Museum.
Do you think they have another one inside their grounds?
They usually do. They usually do, most of those places. But in any event, I think that this person just heard National Cryptological and zoned out. You know, these are words with lots of syllables.
You think she still works there?
She might.
Okay.
She might. But also, the security guard might work there, and he was on the ball.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, despite being kind of nonchalant, smoking a pipe, et cetera. Yeah, he stopped me in my tracks.
So you had a good laugh about it when you realized you were in the wrong place?
I did, actually. I got out of there pretty quickly.
Uh-huh.
But I did it without any gunfire. So that's a testament to, I think, my sense of diplomacy.
I would just remind people that it is a military installation, so they love their orders and giving orders, and they have orders and all of that kind of thing. So it's that kind of environment that you would be thrust into. One thing I will say about the access is it's actually pretty common for people to accidentally go on one of the off-ramps for employees and go up to these gates because the facility itself is surrounded by highways on several sides, and many times people just accidentally take the wrong exit and end up on the other side of this security fence.
Well, we wound up in a parking lot. I think it was adjacent to the Cryptological Museum, but it was a big parking lot, but it wasn't yet on the ground, so you didn't have to go through the gate to get there.
Yeah, it was before the gates. They
but
do have a lot.
We wanted to take pictures because we were putting together one of the first hacker calendars, and the theme was surveillance. And, of course, the NSA, we wanted to give them as much publicity as possible because they're front runners in that. And so I don't know why we did this exactly, but we had this plan. where in the massive parking lot, we were going to walk over to a garbage can, which was literally on the other side of it. So anyone watching us would have seen somebody walking across this entire empty parking lot to throw a single cup into a garbage can. And I guess presumably that's where we would have gotten our shot to take a picture of one of the buildings. Whoever one of us, I forget who did it. I think it must have been you because you're the photographer, walked over and came all the way back. There's records of this, Kyle, and came all the way back to the car, and we thought we were finished, and then we tried to leave, and that's when we got stopped by NSA police. And I think there were three, maybe four cars that wound up surrounding us, asking us questions over and over and over again. And, you know, we just basically said, yeah, we rented a car, drove down to, I think we had to make up a story because we said we were on our way to D.C., and
We lied to the NSA. We did not make up a thing. Someone told us that the NSA has the best crab shack in Maryland.
We did ask that, yes.
And basically they corrected us and said that, no, they actually they've heard this rumor as well, but the crabs actually are in downtown. You have to go to Baltimore to get the best crabs.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, they understood. It's a common misconception. People have bragged and boasted that you can get great food at the NSA Crab Shack, but it actually does not exist.
Okay, there is no such thing. I made up a story. I know. I think I said we were going to D.C. and we just stopped there on the way. Not that you guys were the target, and we drove all the way down there just to take the picture that we got away with. They didn't apparently know that we took a picture. And we used it in the calendar. So we did have great crabs later. We didn't follow their advice because they advised that we go to the harborfront, and that's where all the tourists go. We went into the inner city, you know, by the row houses, and we found a really good place there. But that's another story.
Another interesting thing about the NSA, aside from crabs, actually, is that they actually have really fantastic Christmas ornaments in their gift shop. They sell these Christmas ornaments that are like, you know, satellite receivers and all kinds of electronics, like themed Christmas ornaments. I remember seeing this when I was inside the NSA legitimately, and I regret to this day having not bought a set of these Christmas ornaments.
Voltaire, do you have an NSA story?
No, I was going to ask if the gift shop is open to the public.
No, absolutely not. It's only if you're within the NSA or an NSA employee can you access the gift shop.
I know there was a shopping center there that was part of the there's also a military base with soldiers and things. And you can go there and get discounted food items, but no brand names. But you have to show ID. You used to not have to show ID before.
Okay, that was a different trip. We actually were on Fort Meade for the Chelsea Manning trials.
Yeah, but that's a different instance.
That was a separate trip.
Yeah, I don't think you ever saw the shopping center that I'm talking about.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about the base exchange.
No, never mind. There's
all right.
So many places to go.
So
down there.
Many trips to Fort Meade.
Oh, wow.
Do you know if they had a class
it's
six?
It's a good time of year to go as well. I'm sorry, what?
The class six. Did they have that?
I don't know what you're talking about, class
six.
All
right, well, you can look it up.
All right.
It's a liquor store.
Hey, we are in the middle of a fundraiser. We don't just talk about the NSA all hour long, although we would like to do that. We are trying to keep this radio station going, and this is the winter fundraiser. And the phone number to call, if you just want to pledge straight away, is 516-620-3602. But what we're offering tonight is something rather close to my heart, because it's a project I've been involved in for a number of years now. And that is the 2600 Digital Digest. Now, what that is, it's a compilation of every single issue of 2600 magazine from the very beginning in 1984. 1984 is when we started. All the way until the future. Yeah, it hasn't been defined yet. So basically, what we do is we release every year as an annual digest. So 1984 was the first one. Comes out in PDF format, no copy protection, nothing like that. You get either the entire thing via email, or you get it. You get a link that you can download straight to your computer. You make as many copies as you want, share with as many people as you want. And the really cool thing about it is that you learn a lot about what was happening at that particular time. Now, the issues are interesting enough to read through. Many of them out of print, but they're all available on in digital format now. But in addition to reading the articles, you can read about the behind-the-scenes goings-on that took place putting together the magazine. I believe, Alex, You have a summation of the very first year, 1984. Did you find anything interesting in that summation?
Well, there's a ton of stuff that's interesting here. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to me because I'm learning things. I thought I knew mostly everything about 2600, but you know,
you thought you knew.
No, there's basically, you know, a lot of history here that seems to be shrouded in esoteric symbolism.
A lot of things people have asked about over the years, and we would never tell them. And now, we're not telling all, but we're telling most.
Well, here's something I think is really quite interesting, which is the masthead here, and sort of the evolution of the masthead.
The masthead, yes.
Yeah, the masthead, you know, I'll read a little bit from this, but you know, the overall look of the masthead was fairly traditional, with the name 2600 off to the left in Times Bold.
This is our first year, for the first year you're talking about.
Yeah, the first year, 1984, to be clear. A generic month and year to the right, and a volume and number in all caps and italics below. This left a little bit of space in the middle for us to play with, something which quickly grew out of control. So all kinds of interesting references from history here. I mean, there are references to The Clash here, to the Sedinista album, I think, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
References to Cicero, the Roman philosopher.
Uh-huh. Of course.
Showed up over there. Very, very interesting things. 1-800 numbers, May 1984, saw a reference to 1-800 numbers, which were the salvation of many a phone freak at the time. Back then, not only were 800 numbers free of charge, which they still are, but they didn't even ever trace your number.
That's right.
So this is predating ANI.
Now, imagine you call an 800 number and you could feel secure that the person on the other end would not know who you are, where you're calling from. And now, you know, these days we just assume that when we call somebody, unless we specifically block the number, and you can't do that for an 800 number, that your name is going to be given away. And that's just normal now.
Well, right. I mean, back in the mid-90s when phone phreaking was still very popular, you know, ANI was something that was prevalent with 1-800 numbers, and you had to go through diverters in order to block your number from being listed over there. And that's something you would set your modem to do in various ways.
What's a diverter? That's something you can learn if you get the digest, right?
That's
true. All kinds of terminology that Alex is speaking about now that is all explained. Hey, let me just give you the information now for people who are interested in this. What we're offering is a lifetime subscription to this. In other words, you'll get every single issue from the very first one up until the present. We're still releasing a few years in between. We're releasing them every 3 months, but we've gotten all the way up to 2001. And I think we have maybe a 5-year gap that we'll be releasing over the next year or so. And then every year we release a digest for the previous year. So you're going to be getting digest forever or until we stop publishing. And you're going to get all the ones that have come out so far. The phone number, 516-620-3602. Normally, that sells on our website for $260. And it's a very popular item. It's the lifetime subscription to the Digital Digest. We are offering it tonight for only $100. So that's less than half the cost of the normal price that nobody complains about. So it's a really good deal. 516-620-3602. We're donating this to the radio station because we believe in the radio station, and we hope you do too. And this way you get something really cool out of it. Now, the way it works, you give your email address when you make your pledge. And as of April 1st, that is the cutoff that we are establishing, we are going to check with the station. We're going to see who paid. And if you paid your pledge, your email address will be sent all of the digest. Simple as that. April 1st. That is the cutoff. 516-620-3602. But pledge now. $100. Get you officially refer to it as the Hacker Digest lifetime subscription. You get that, and everything else will fall into place.
I think it's a great deal because it sort of demystifies a lot about 2600, a lot about this show. You'll get a lot of these sort of esoteric references that we'll be making in the future. And you can really trace the evolution of our ideology and philosophy. And frankly, I'm not done with 1984 yet,
no,
by the way.
And
towards the end of the year, though, is something I want to ask you about.
You're just looking at the summation. You're not even looking at the issues yet.
I'm not even looking at the issues.
Imagine you get all the issues for the year, and you get to read all the articles about new and emerging technology back then.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure in the very first issue, we're talking about the NSA, what we're talking about right now. We're revealing various things that they don't want us to reveal.
Well,
all kinds of things that we've done.
All kinds of, you know, things that don't exist anymore either.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, on the cover of the issue, I think, you know, you had things back in 1984 like a telex number, an MCI mail address.
Oh, yes.
A Western Union EasyLink account.
Wow.
You know, all kinds of bizarre things that really most people that were born in the 90s probably don't really know about.
It's great to see corporate America try ideas that just end in disaster. And there are so many examples of that just with the phone companies alone that we basically focus on, mock and ridicule to the greatest extent possible, and also theorize as to what's next, what will be developed in the future. Keep in mind, when this magazine started coming out, there was no internet. It did not exist in its present form.
Of course.
So we had to talk about that possibility and how that might evolve. We've seen things change. We've seen every bit of technology change in so many different ways. We've seen the commercialization of the net. We've seen the explosion of the personal computer. We've seen phones change more than 180 degrees, all kinds of from making phone calls in the first place, from who you pay your phone bill to the emergence of cell phones and the change in technology just in that field alone. It's all there. All that history is encapsulated. It's, you know, having gone through all of this, and I do spend a lot of time reading through the old issues to write up the summaries, it's fascinating. You don't want to put down the articles. Yeah, they might be 20 years old, 30 years old, but they still have that hacker spirit to them, and they remind you of things. They make you think, hey, wait a minute, this is what we wanted to do. This is what we were talking about. How come we never did that? And then all of a sudden, you've rejuvenated that interest.
Yeah, you know, some might actually call this magenta fascinating. It really is.
Is that a T-Mobile reference?
I don't know. Could be another one of these esoteric references. But I've got a very interesting bit here that I want to address with you.
Okay.
And it actually has to do with laundromats.
Oh, God.
Okay.
All right.
So the last issue of the first year, so December 1984.
Just so people know, the first 4 years, we were monthly. The first three of those years, we were simply a few pages of 8.5 by 11 paper. That's all it was.
Yep.
It was a newsletter. Three sheets of paper was our first issue, and we just stuffed it in envelopes and mailed it to people that had sent us envelopes. That was all it took. You send us an envelope, we'll send you this newsletter. And it was kind of inspired by Tap magazine, which had come out in the 70s and early 80s. And we just basically wondered what would happen after we fully expected to be arrested after sending this out, because we were on BBSs, we were in the middle of an investigation by the FBI, and we didn't know what would happen next. We kind of didn't expect it to get this popular, but it sure did. So everything, every little bit of history from that very first issue, those very first words, where we basically blew an FBI investigation too, because we had somebody on the inside that was able to reveal that they were about to arrest a bunch of people, and the whole case was blown in our very first issue, to the things we talk about today, the new forms of technology, and, of course, the letters to the editor. Every single one of those are included, some classic letters that people have written to us over the decades, all yours for a pledge of $100 in digital format, PDFs. You'll be able to read these to your heart's content, copy them to however many devices you want, and they will never disappear. 516-620-3602, less than half the normal cost, available tonight, pledge of $100.
Okay, well, you've talked about a lot of different topics here very quickly, but you have not succeeded in changing the subject from the laundromat.
No, you're too good for me.
So, you can't get one past me here. The December issue had the upside-down word false, spelled P-H-A-L-S-E, which was a clear reference to the hacker group Freakers, Hackers, and Laundromat Service Employees, which were the people who got together to form 2600 back in 1983. They also caused the federal authorities to investigate a possible connection between hackers and laundromats.
True.
Even though the group name was only used in order to make the acronym look and sound cool.
We wanted something. We wanted to come up with a cool word,
yes.
You know, and false spelled with a PH was a cool word. I mean, Freakers spelled with a P, Hackers spelled with an A, You know, we just couldn't figure out the rest to make it into false. So, and okay, we could A, that's the A. What's LSE? What can we possibly do with LSE? And one of us just came up with the idea of, well, why not just say Laundromat Service Employees and leave it at that? And, you know, that seemed good enough for us. But actually, you know, unintentionally, there was that FBI investigation I was telling you about. We were kind of in the middle of that. We found out later that they actually did launch an investigation trying to figure out what the connection was to laundromats and hackers, because that name was being thrown around all over the place and there had to be some kind of a connection. And they, I don't know what they did, But one of the agents told me, yeah, that was a thing. We had to actually spend time looking into that.
Well, it's interesting because you've been talking about laundromats for the last couple of weeks, too. You know, they've been part of the subject, so maybe there is an actual...
Well, I'm not saying there isn't a connection with hackers and laundromats. We use laundromats. Yes. We went to laundromats. It's just it wasn't really where we conducted business. That was a whole other story. But yes, Walter.
Is it true that this was the inspiration for Gus from Breaking Bad's front business?
I wouldn't say that. No, I'm sure we weren't the first people to mislead the authorities and have fronts of various sorts or fake fronts. It was a bit of fun. You know, humor is always a part of everything that we do. And you see that reflected in the pages, not only of 2600, but in the hacker community in general. But I think, you know, if you're looking for a good taste of what it's been all about all this time, this is the quickest, most extensive way of getting that. It's bigger than any book you could possibly imagine.
And it's kind of neat, too, to think about this as just being, you know, a couple of pages of a few sheets of 8.5 by 11 paper way back in 1984, and to see how it's evolved, see how the technology's evolved. But speaking of technology, I wanted to ask you, 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper, where did you make these photocopies?
All right. Well, that's something I really don't want to reveal because I still know some of the people involved. But it involves sneaking into offices after midnight. No, I'm not kidding.
I know.
Sneaking into offices after midnight and making unauthorized copies, because back then, you know, it wasn't easy to do this kind of thing.
That's right. I mean, the photocopy machine was an amazing piece of technology back
then. It was a good machine, and it served our purposes. Now, of course, when we started printing hundreds of the things, we couldn't do that anymore. We had to go to a bona fide printer. But those first, see, that's the secret of the whole developing something new. You start out small. And we started out so small that basically what we weren't outright stealing. I just mean like borrowing services. We basically were doing for cheap or volunteer time. And that's how we grew. We just kept expanding from there until we got to the point where, okay, people are actually subscribing now. We can pay for a printer. So now we can print the thing and have more pages. And it just kind of grew from there.
I mean, it was a very rebellious thing to do. It was a kind of startup attitude back in the 80s.
Well, it seemed like a necessary thing to do because we were on the BBSs, bulletin board systems. You know, basically, you call up somebody's computer and you connect. One person connects at a time, 300 baud. And you read stories, and hackers were telling stories about systems they were penetrating, or phone freaks were telling stories about the phone system, or people were discussing trashing, jumping into trash cans. And basically, what we saw was potential to tell these stories to a bigger audience, to people that didn't have computers, because not everybody, in fact, very few people had computers back then. So we wanted to share that culture, because that culture was interesting. You know, War Games had just come out. It was something that people really seemed fascinated by, and the spirit was contagious. So, you know, we had seen Tap Magazine. We had seen what they did. We thought we could do better. And we basically solicited a bunch of these stories from the BBSs, and we collected them, printed them out, got a nice typesetting machine, borrowed the nice typesetting machine to make it seem professional. And the rest is history.
I mean, what's fascinating to me about these older stories, too, is that so many of them focus on the phone system itself. And, you know, we sort of forget that the phone system in phreaking was an art, and it was a dark art back in the day. And also the printing of raw data. You know, I think it was page 5, wasn't it, that was printing raw data.
At one point it was page 5, yes.
Right. Just that very act alone is something that seems kind of strange today, because data is just available everywhere you look. I mean, we don't leave the house without, you know, at least, you know, 128 gigs on us every day. So that was something that was just impossible to even imagine back in 1984. So the printing of telephone numbers, the printing of dial-up numbers for modems, you know, this was a really rebellious act for people that were starving for information.
It was rebellious, and it was met as such by many of the powers that be. Both our readers and our writers were penalized in many ways. I mean, kids all over the country were being thrown into detention because they had a copy of 2600 on them, or because they explained computers better than the teacher could. Were suspicious in one way or another. And of course, we were threatened and sued many, many times for printing the things that we printed and saying the things that we said. So, yeah, you know, it was something that was necessary, but you know, I don't regret any of it. It was something that was a lot of fun and, you know, expensive to do because when you're the enemy of powerful entities, there is a cost. Absolutely.
Yeah, and you see that reflected in the letters. You mm-hmm. see people writing in for many, many years. I mean, even, you know, a decade and a half or so later, people are still writing the letters to the editor about being penalized for having copies of 2600. I mean, it is still, to this day, I think, a subversive publication.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, you're very welcome.
Now, Kyle, I know you have 10 years in the future. You have a summation for 1994. Now, you know, people were saying that the hacker world was dead literally the year after we started publishing, 1985. And people continue to say that. People continue to say, oh, you know, it's nothing like it used to be. And yeah, they're right. It's nothing like it used to be. But it's still very much there. The hacker spirit lives on. And 1994, I know there were a lot of naysayers, people saying that, yeah, the magic is gone then too. But I don't think that was really the case. 1994, there were all sorts of interesting developments. I know the internet was just starting up and, you know, in its present form and all kinds of other things. Do you have any kind of selection there?
Well, geez, God, I mean, where do you even start? There was a lot going on just even outside of, I think, the hacking community in 2600. But 2600 was there to tell the story and really give people details about stuff that they really hadn't wondered about or hadn't had as much exposure to. Mm-hmm. Of note, I think there's discussion both on the covers and then inside some of the issues that year about this Clipper chip.
Oh, the Clipper chip.
The one that was blown up at Hope.
And 1994 was our first conference.
Yeah,
so you just pick any year and something happened there.
Oh, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Wow.
There's a section here actually talking about the president@whitehouse.gov email address. It was just announced in 1994.
Who was the president back? Truman? It was
Clinton.
Was it Clinton?
It must have been Clinton.
Just this section kind of refers to it. We saw disturbing moves by the government with regards to encryption in the form of the Clipper chip, a secretive encryption chipset developed by the NSA for the purpose of spying on our voice transmissions. And I'll just say that they like to make their own chips. I think they have a chip fab. They make their own hardware, and they do have an interest in our voice transmissions.
It's
just
funny how we
putting
keep
that out there,
returning to that theme.
Yeah, it's, I think, kind of redundant to say now, but I'll just say it. Yes, they were doing this for the purpose of spying on our voice transmissions. Along with many others, we condemn this development, along with the implication that many other forms of encryption would be forbidden. The quote is, the Clinton administration is becoming obsessed with monitoring citizens. Well, this isn't really unique to administrations,
yeah,
but it's...
And, you know, this is also to those people who say that we are, you know, just left-wing and anti-Trump and anti-Republican. Look at what Kyle just read there. We came down so hard on the Clinton administration throughout the 8 years they were in power on all the attacks that they had on freedom of speech on the net. So anybody in power is going to get it. So we're biased in favor of freedom, not in favor of political parties.
Yeah, yeah, and this just underlined a lot of what we now talk about as privacy issues, but was emerging as a big theme, privacy and the ability to control it and have a say. There's another section here, actually, that kind of refers to that. Apparently, in some of the articles, there was discussion of IVR systems and voicemail, which was becoming popular.
Oh, wow.
And 2600 was at the front of this, kind of with the counterintuitive argument of, hey, this might be handy, but you're relinquishing all of your messages, at least an answering machine. The tape is in your house, right? But with voicemail systems being part of the phone system, part of the emerging 5ESS or late 4ESS, whatever packages the switches were able to then offer with SS7 switching, the new protocols coming out, it hands a bit of your information. You're using a feature that might be convenient, but it's actually owned. It's on the premise of the phone company and their security, as is said here, it says their security was unproven and it was a form of losing control of something personal.
And look at what happened since then. Look at how many times those words have proven to be correct. I wonder how many people still have answering machines. Pretty much, you know, We lost a number of battles. I know we were anti-caller ID. We were anti-people using voicemail for everything. And, of course, people use caller ID all the time. People use voicemail for every little thing. And you don't have as much control. Like you said, tapes. You know, answering machine tapes. I've got so many of those over the years that I've collected. But I always will have them until I decide to destroy them.
Well, and also, I mean, even now, you can buy solid-state, like, tapeless answering machines, mm-hmm. and you have control. You're physically, you know, containing that device. You aren't relinquishing the information that people will leave when they get an answering service to the phone company, and having it centrally stored, which makes it a lot easier, as we've found out, when there are interfaces and abilities and sort of the era of warrantless wiretap. This was all precursor to that. There is a discussion in those years, 1994, of caller ID. I could go on. There's so much stuff here.
Well, I think what you find is that we always talk about the technology. We always question the technology. It's not like we're afraid of the technology. It's not like we blindly embrace it. We kind of go in the middle where we try and break it one way or another and see what the what-ifs are. Or this is an excerpt from 1994, 10 years into the 2600 Lifetime Digital Digest that we're offering tonight for a pledge of $100, 516-620-3602. And you call that number, just pledge $100, ask for the Hacker Digest Lifetime subscription, and you will get every year that we have put out so far, in addition to every year that we put out in the future. And you will learn so much about the hacker community. You'll see every article that has ever been printed. And you'll read all these summations. Now, Kyle, you're reading from 1994, and I know that Alex was reading from 1984. We didn't have actual covers then because it was the newsletter format. In 1994, we had covers. So what you have some explanations as to what the covers mean.
I alluded to that when I started talking about this. Uh-huh. There are a couple issues with – well, all of them had these great, great full-color covers. Color sort of – slowly began to emerge something. I'm sure part of that small growth you were discussing earlier.
We evolved and we learned from our mistakes.
That's right. And anyway, excuse me. The let's see, all kinds of information, stuff about IRC. There were mini covers, small vignetted, I think, graphics. I think on one cover, the mini cover featured the logo for New York City's brand new MetroCard service.
Oh, boy.
Yes, we all know that logo. Uh-huh. Look in your wallet or your strap hanging. You can see that logo now. But it was on a early issue of 2600, celebrating the beginning of that. Another thing I did want to mention that started that year, sadly, Haktik, a great Dutch zine, hacker magazine that was around at the time and an inspiration for 2600, I'm sure. They were closing, and I think there's some headstones in one of the covers, or an open grave actually for that magazine, which was ending, just with the Haktik text on the grave. And but the exciting last thing I will add is that 2600.com, yes, our domain, the numeric .com homepage for the magazine, emerged, and it just simply said 2600.com will soon be in operation on the internet.
Wow. And that sure worked out, didn't it?
it is still our homepage to this day, and just one of the many, many things just in that year alone. And I just want to say, this is a great, great package. It's portable. It's a great way for you to catch up on technology, hacking, the sort of emergence of how we communicate, how we share information, these sort of legalities and a lot of the early manifestations of law and how those things morphed and became the kinds of case law that we discuss every day, every Wednesday on this show. And it's just a great way for you to become a real expert on hacking history as 2600 has reported and covered it over the years. I do want to just say you can donate, you can pledge any amount. This pledge is called the Hacker Digest Lifetime Subscription at the $100 level. That's a drastically reduced rate. We're offering, we're donating that to the station as a thank you. And I just want to say any amount, really, this radio station is such a vital, vital voice in New York City here. It allows us to do what we do. It augments our publishing, our conference, and our other activities on the internet and elsewhere, whether it's IRC or anything. We really, we need this as much as any of the other producers would say, as a cohesive part of our community. And we bring in people. We learn from other people that call and write to the show. And we can turn people on to hacking and technology, and maybe they then point out things that we never saw over the years. And that's really, really important for human understanding of technology and how we're wielding it over one another.
That's a very good point. And WBAI's connection here is a vital one, one that we've had since 1988. In fact, that's documented in the magazine as well. But the stories that we have focused upon here that affected our community, such as when Fiber Optic was a co-host of the show and was sent to prison, the Bernie S. saga that we focused on for a couple of years, of course, the Kevin Mitnick story, all of that was brought to so many more people through these airwaves. And by working with 2600, we were able to reach so many more people. And that's why this place remains crucial, and it's a voice that we need to maintain and keep strong. And you can do that by calling 516-620-3602. The pledge amount for this package, $100, as Kyle said, it's drastically slashed from the normal 260 rate. And you will get every single issue that has come out so far on PDF format, which basically is something you can read on your computer, you can read it on your phone, you can read it on any digital device, and you can copy it as many times as you want, you can share it with people, and learn so much about the whole process, the whole history-making period. You get not only the issues, but you get every single year. I printed out for a couple of years here. There are something like 8 or 9 pages of 8.5 by 11 typed, just describing the issues for that year, and then you have the issues on top of that.
You know, one thing that sort of struck me as we're talking about this right now is that when you read these old issues, especially back in the 90s, you get this sense that 2600 is a publication, it's part of the press, yet it was constantly being attacked.
Mm-hmm.
It was constantly under threat. You're going to read stories about things like the Secret Service raiding the Pentagon City Mall down in Virginia.
Oh, wow, yes.
Remember that?
1992.
Absolutely. That was huge. I mean, mm-hmm. I remember these things, you know, when they happened, and sort of, you know, reliving them now, sort of, you know, with a little bit of PTSD, I guess, and thinking about some of these stories. But it goes to show you that attacks on the press are not a new thing. They've been going on for a really, really long time. Attacks on those who report unpopular facts has been going on for decades. This is not just this current administration. And it goes to show you why 2600 is so important and why WBAI is so important. Mm-hmm. And again, I think, again, they go hand in hand. 516-620-3602, pledge to support independent press, independent radio. Keep us on the air. Keep us publishing.
When we had that that raid of our meeting in Washington, D.C., I believe it was 1992, that basically led to us meeting all kinds of new allies in the civil liberties world. So every time that we were attacked in one way or another, it strengthened us. We met more people. We got more supporters. And, you know, in fact, 1990, we were talking about this last week when we mentioned the passing of our friend John Perry Barlow, co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. One of the major reasons the need for the EFF was seen back in 1990 was because of hacker raids throughout the country, including one that took place in Austin, the Steve Jackson Games case. These communities got together by sharing stories, by reading the same publications, by talking on the radio. And that's what helped make this community that we all live in today possible in the first place. It continues. You know, we continue to talk to all these people, and more communities are being spun off as a result. We have conferences, we have meetings, we have publications and broadcasts. It all is a part of this story, and what we're offering tonight is the story. You can have the entire thing. Pledge of $100, 516-620-3602. Kyle.
You can also donate to the station by texting WBAI to the short number 41444. That's WBAI, and you'll get a link where you can contribute online as a response to your SMS. Also online, give to WBAI.org. That's a direct address to the online donation. The package we're offering now is the Hacker Digest Lifetime Subscription, but any contribution is a real substantive fundraising donation. I mean, it's so important. I'm at a loss for words. We're at a point where every bit of your contributions help. This is merely a thank you. The $2,600 is offering for your pledge at the $100 level. But, you know, that's if you really value this. It's the most concise, compact, condensed way to take all of this history with you, share with other people, do with it what you will. But the real important thing is to donate to WBAI today. So please, any contribution you can, if you can make this $100 level, we guarantee you, you'll be really satisfied with this. It is a fantastic compendium of information about hacking, hacker culture, history, telephony, computers, just about everything.
And the PDF format is readable on any computer. You can read it on your phone. 516-620-3602, $100 pledge gets the lifetime subscription to all the back issues and all the future issues. But I have 2,000. I pulled 2,000. And that was another moment. In fact, every year is momentous in one way or another. But this was the year that Kevin Mitnick was released from prison. And we had been following that story for years about the computer hacker who was basically kept in prison for 5 years without any clear charges against him. And it's very interesting what happened right at the period of time where that saga ended. Here's a quote from the Digest. With the end of the Kevin Mitnick saga scheduled for January, we thought things would finally calm down. We were wrong. It was with the precision of a soap opera that one crisis was immediately succeeded by the next. On the very day before Kevin Mitnick's release, we at 2600 became the latest targets of a world gone mad with litigation and incarceration. The Motion Picture Association of America decided that we were somehow responsible for a tool on the internet known as DECSS, which existed solely to bypass access controls on DVD technology and allow Linux machines to play DVDs. Imagine that. Well, we don't even have a working DVD player, and here they were accusing us of piracy. It had nothing to do with piracy. We've talked about this many, many times. It had to do with control of technology. We had a lot on our side. The Free Kevin movement helped train us in organization skills. Never before have we seen such awareness and education on the part of the hacker community. There were massive demonstrations, well, I wouldn't say massive demonstrations, but a massive amount of demonstrations throughout the world in support of our case and what we were doing. This was our latest challenge. We had to fight another battle the second that this first battle had ended. Well, it wasn't even the first battle. It was just the one that had taken up years and years of our time.
You know, you mentioned this case, you mentioned Bernie S., you mentioned Fiber, all these things. You know, they were really formative to me. Going through that in the 90s and then into the early 2000s was really one of the reasons why I decided to go to law school and become a lawyer. It was, you know, going through that, and, you know, for young people today to be able to sort of relive that and relive that rebellious spirit through this compendium, this historical record of the hacker spirit, I think is really important as well. And, you know, looking back at this lawsuit as a practicing lawyer now for, you know, a good number of years, I do remember there was a preliminary injunction that was issued against you that prevented you from disseminating the DCSS source code over there. And I think it's probably in the magazine as well, but how you maneuvered around that preliminary injunction and allowed the information to get out at any cost and at great potential liability to the magazine and yourself, I look back at it now and think that was actually really kind of cool, very smart, and very neat. So you'll see all of this. You'll see all of it in the record. The whole story is there. The fight between the MPAA and 2600. The case itself, I think, went to the Second Circuit. In fact, we had Kathleen Sullivan come out, the dean of Stanford's law school, flew out and argued the case in front of the Second Circuit pro bono for 2600. And I believe the name of the case is Universal Studios v. Ramirez. It doesn't actually have 2600 in the caption.
Yeah, it had the first defendant who had since dropped out of the case. That's how it works.
That's right. Yep, that's exactly right. But it's a really fascinating read. It's an incredible case, and it was a real battle.
Let me just read a couple more words about the year 2000. For whatever reason, 2000 was the year of the lawsuit, particularly the year of the lawsuit against us. We received a legal threat from Staples over an article that had appeared in the previous issue, which sought to advise us on finding the line where freedom of speech ends and corporate infringement begins. Well, we advised them that while we appreciate the suggestions on how to run our business, we feel your needs would be best suited if you simply minded yours. When they demanded that we reveal the name of the author of the story, we made our position quite clear. We will never reveal a source without that source's explicit permission, and we won't cave in to threats of any sort. We printed the whole thing in our letters section. The writer of the story even wrote in to reemphasize our position. And it continued. A new company called Verizon threatened us for registering VerizonReallySucks.com as a counter to their registering VerizonSucks.com. That's right. They went out and they registered their own Verizon Sucks to keep people from criticizing the company. They actually accused us of cyber squatting. Now, while we're pleased that we may be Verizon's very first lawsuit, we're annoyed at the utter waste of time these huge entities continue to waste. We found that I wouldn't have written it that way. I wouldn't have used the word waste twice in a sentence. When you go back on this, you see how you could have done better. Yeah. We found that the new massive company formed by the merger between Bell Atlantic and GTE had registered no fewer than 706 domains, many of which were names critical of the company. We printed them all. Apparently, they thought taking control of these phrases would prevent people from criticizing them. They had no idea what they were up against. and that went on for a while. They eventually dropped that threat. In fact, they even went back and said, yeah, this is freedom of speech, and we support it. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Well, that sort of sparked VerizonEatsPoop.com, VerizonReallySucks.com, and Verizon should spend more time fixing its network and less money on lawyers.com, if I recall.
Yeah, correctly. I think that was that used every single letter possible in a domain name. But yeah, 2000 was filled with all kinds of battles and challenges and fights. One year out of more than 30 that we have printed so far. Walter.
What year do you think you realize that you'd probably be spending the rest of your life on this project?
Well, who said I'm going to spend the rest of my life on this project? I don't know.
Yeah, we have an announcement.
Yeah, it's basically, at some point you realize, boy, I spend an awful lot of time on this. And I'm realizing that now, definitely. But you know what? You can sort of ease the pain of that realization by calling 516-620-3602, pledging $100, asking politely for the digital. I lost the page that has a specific name of it's the. Do you have it?
The name of the package is Hacker Digest Lifetime Subscription.
Yeah, you got to say it just right, or you get something else.
Hacker Digest Lifetime Subscription.
$100, 516-620-3602, and you'll get everything from 1984 through 1994 through 2000 and all the years in between, and you'll get the most recent as well, and you'll get everything into the future. Again, 516-620-3602. Make sure you give your email address to the person taking your pledge. That way we send you the digest to the right place, and we will be doing that as of April 1st when we check everybody's status. And if you've paid up by then you're on track to get digest, as long as there are digests. So I think it's pretty neat. And you know, I was going to print out more years, but I realized there's an awful lot of material here. I didn't have enough paper for one thing.
No. And the magazine is now 68 pages in the digest format. That's the paper edition. So it's amazing to have gone from 3 pages, 8.5 by 10.
Well, 6 pages, technically.
Yeah, I guess that's 6 digest pages to now nearly 70.
Wow.
It's a lot of information.
Yeah, it really is. I want to thank people for calling in, for supporting the radio station. Again, that phone number, 516-620-3602. Every little bit counts. Every ounce of your support has meant so much over the years, both with the magazine and the radio station and everything else that that we do and that we get involved in. And that's why we continue to do it here on WBAI, where you hear so many voices in the course of a day, let alone a week. You can make those voices stronger. You can make this radio station survive and keep doing what it's doing. 516-620-3602. Website give2wbai.org. You can text to 41444 with the letters WBAI. All kinds of ways. Become a BAI buddy and pledge a few cents every day. It's up to you.
Yeah, it's so important, and we really appreciate any contribution you can make. So please donate to WBAI.
Happy New Year, everybody.
And thank you to everybody that pledged last week.
Oh, yes.
For the
That's right.
Blackstone Law Group.
Yes.
Legal package. So look forward to working with you, and thank you.
Have a good night.
Happy hacking.
Yo, check this out. This is Chuck, the Public Enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI.
Today is February the 14th, 2018. It's Ash Wednesday, a day of fasting, and it is the first day of Lent in Western Christianity. It is computed using an algorithm based on the ecclesiastic rules and tables of the 1582 Gregorian calendar reform. Well, exactly what is the algorithm? Let me find my abacus. It's also Valentine's Day. If you haven't sent out that special message, go online and select an appropriate passage from Sonnet 43 by Elizabeth Barrett Browning for someone special. And a shout-out from us to all our listeners. You are special to us. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of All Things Computing. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Podcast of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and our website pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI FM 99.5 on the radio and PRN.FM on the Internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program. However, tonight, WBAI is in a membership drive, so the program is a little different. On WBAI, we are in the midst of another membership drive. We've been asked, what premiums have we to offer? We've decided to go back to basics. The difficulties in the premium process has exasperated and outweighed the goodwill of our listening audience. We now are just asking for your basic support with a cash donation. Just say it is for your favorite program, The Personal Computer Show. We understand that you may want to receive a premium which is offered on another program. If I were a listener, I may want to maximize my donation. We have no issue with that if that is your choice. In our case, we don't have the priority of getting premium pledges fulfilled. The program itself has been subject to challenges in available equipment and communications access. We are regularly preempted. So, why do we continue with all these challenges? Almost all of the computer media are hardware manufacturer and software publisher centric. It is rare you see or hear something in which the consumer interest comes first. We do feel we offer you, the listening audience, a premium each time we are on the air. It is a technical information with both a negative and positive perspective of what is in the best interest of the consumer. We ask the key questions. What is the business model for the product? We also ask and evaluate the usability of the product. Our personal technical knowledge base of information goes back to the days of vacuum tubes, paper tapes, and punch cards. So we ask that you support the show with your donation. We know it to be sincere, and there are no premium strings attached. The 9/11 Emergency Service Fee provides funding for the operation of 9/11 emergency telecommunication services in your area. Emergency personnel must have the capability to identify the location of a caller when they dial 911. The fee, which is applied per access line, funds communication systems that support emergency and quick response for the police, fire, and ambulance services with identification of the phone number and the location of the call. Customers pay for this service and other 9/11 communication costs through state and county 9/11 surcharges. Not all counties have 9/11 systems yet, but may collect for future implementation. Two members of the Federal Communications Commission, one is a Democrat, one is Republican, so it's bipartisan, want to stop states from using 9/11 funds to pay for other government services or equipment. On our individual phone bills, a line item is typically included for 9/11 service. It's a relatively small fee that states and localities charge to support emergency calling services. But too many states are stealing these funds and using them for other purposes like filling budget gaps, purchasing vehicles, or worse. The FCC latest annual report on 9/11 fees covering calendar year 2016 said that New Mexico, Rhode Island, Illinois, New Jersey, and West Virginia have been diverting 9/11 funds, which totals almost $130 million. Besides those five states, another seven didn't even bother to respond. So there's a heck of a lot more money that's being diverted. New York is one state that did not submit a report to the FCC data collection, but sufficient public record information exists to support a finding that New York has been diverting funds for non-public safety use. 9/11 fees are applied to landline and wireless phone plans via monthly bills. The fees range by state. In six states that diverted funds in 2016, the monthly fees range from as low as 51 cents to $6.40 per monthly bill. This is according to the National Emergency Number Association. Within some states, the fees can vary by county or city, and that $6.40 charge is only applied in parts of West Virginia, while fees are as low as 98 cents elsewhere in that state. For example, Chicago has a monthly fee of $3.90, while other parts of Chicago pay only 87 cents. The FCC, with its jurisdiction over interstate communications, has the right to bar diverting states from imposing 9/11 fees on interstate calls. In addition to commission options, Congress has full ability to correct diversion of states' practices either by directly applying existing law or by exerting necessary leverage via its extensive grants and funding programs. many of the funds that are allocated for specific use are diverted for other uses. And when they run out of money, they come back and say, oh, we have to raise the cost because it was insufficient funding. Hey, if you start using those funds for not the purpose it was intended for, of course you don't have sufficient funds. We have to stop this. Now, we have these two FCC commissioners that are trying to stop it. You should write to your congressmen, your legislative leaders, and say, we are in support of these two FCC commissioners. Do your job. Make sure the funds are not diverted. And if they're going to be diverted, then the funds should not even be taken or tacked onto a bill. On Sunday, February the 4th, the world was watching the Philadelphia Eagles defeat the New England Patriots to win Super Bowl 52. Verizon and Samsung conducted some under-the-radar testing of the 5G network, and the results were impressive, as we're told. Three things in particular should stand out about the successful test. 5G-ready hardware was involved. For the test, Samsung said it developed 5G tablets that were able to deliver multi-gigabyte per second speeds on 5G and top 4G LTE speeds and proper switching between 5G and 4G networks. In addition to this, because of the fact that multiple carriers were involved, additional hardware was needed, including 28 gigahertz 5G access units and home routers, which means that the consumer-ready products are close to being ready. Multiple cities were involved in the test. Verizon using an area within the U.S. Bank Stadium in Minneapolis where the Super Bowl was being played was able to make a 5G video call to Seoul, South Korea. Additionally, to display the possibilities of extremely high bandwidth and low latency that 5G will offer, Verizon streamed live 180-degree stereoscopic video from the field in Minneapolis to virtual reality headsets in New York City. That demo reportedly required multiple 4K and HD video streams over their 5G network. Verizon was able to stream multiple 4K and high-def video feeds over their 5G network to virtual reality headsets in a different city. With the international video call, it was described as the first ever 5G video call on prototype 5G tablets, and the call was completed in high quality with no disruption. Oh yes, the Super Bowl Sunday saw a big win for Philadelphia Eagles, winning 41-33. Testing will continue at the Winter Olympics.
Hank, remember when we were first starting at the station? It was offices and studios were on 8th Avenue. We had to take the freight elevator up because we were on at 7:30 on Sunday nights. The other thing that was very different back in those days is virtually nobody used premiums. Yes, there were one or two shows Saturday morning and had tickets and things like that. But for the most part, nobody used premiums. And then we found out that many of the guests that we had on the air from major manufacturers and software people were only too happy to donate software to the station to be used as premiums for the membership drives. And we used to do what we called a marathon 3 or 4 times a year, where we would stay on the air for 2 or 3 hours, and we would offer premiums like DBASED 2 and language software and all sorts of really good things at the equivalent of 25 or 35 or 50% of the retail value. And we used to raise $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 during each marathon. Well, pretty soon everybody took notice. Everybody at the station took notice. And they too started offering premiums. And as most good things, they managed to foul up the whole system. Today we get emails, phone calls, mails, snail mails even, from people all over the country who haven't gotten the premiums that they've paid for and counted on receiving. One chap went so far as to say he would be happy to pick it up at the station. And even then, they fouled up what they gave him. So we've pretty much decided no more premiums for the personal computer show. Let's go back to the early days, 35 years ago. Do you enjoy listening to us? Do you enjoy the, well, I was going to say the banter, but we've lost our telephones and we don't have that anymore either. How about this? How about saying pay-per-view, pay-per-listen? If you enjoy this show, if you enjoy listening to us every week, why not go online? Hank will give you the phone number and make a pledge to your favorite show. Every pledge of $25 helps so much.